Thank you very much indeed. Thank you to Barbara and Patrick for inviting me here today and organising this very interesting workshop. So before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge all my co-workers, and in particular Fanny Gorell, who did a lot of the work on especially the first part of what I'll be presenting here. And Fanny's with us here today, so she might be able to answer some questions. Kind of. But not when it's shining on the screen. And the first part's been published open access in GCubed. Okay, so we're interested in, as we heard today earlier, about flow through the mantle, and maybe there's been layering, maybe over time, etc. And clearly one candidate is the region of the transition zone, and we might consider this as a whole sort of mantle convection engine, which might be including the...
Is that a little better?
Okay, we'll see, thanks. So I'm interested in sort of trying to understand how this sort of valve works. The valve could be totally closed, which would be a totally layered mantle. The valve could be totally open, which would be a whole mantle sort of convection with no hindrance at that boundary. But clearly we have subduction pictures, clearly over many generations now, and showing us in some cases clearly where slabs are passing through that boundary very cleanly, but in other regions where the slabs are stagnating. So maybe there is something going on in this region, and can we understand it? And clearly we've heard earlier about the phase changes, and that's clearly what's giving us the transition zone in terms of seismic velocity variations. And clearly we're going to have different minerals, both on the pyroxene side and the olivine side of the system, and they will have different material properties, including rheology, but also the phase change itself, for example, from ringwoodite to bridgmanite, or as we used to call it, perovskite itself, as we heard, the phase change itself is also potentially important. So the way that the phase change, the endothermic phase change at 660, can generate layering can be explained in this simple diagram here. So here's the PT graph. So here's the ringwoodite, the closer to the surface phase, the less dense phase. Here's bridgmanite or perovskite, the denser, deeper phase. So if we're at the equilibrium temperature where it's at its natural depth of 660, then we're at this point. If we happen to be at point A, which is, as we see, a colder temperature, so this would be a colder piece of the mantle, it would be at a higher pressure. So in physical space, we've got this figure here. So here we're at the natural level of the phase transition. Now we're going deeper and we're colder. So in this deeper region, this material here is clearly less dense than the material around. So this gives a buoyancy restoring force. And that in principle can lead to a layering in the system. And we've known this for a long time. So here's a snapshot of a 3D model, convection model. Relatively simple in terms of its rheology, and it's a little bit different to see in terms because it's a 3D picture, but you probably can kind of see here subducting things stopping about this level and upwelling things stopping at this level. This, at this point in this simulation, this was perfectly layered. So we're looking at temperature at the core mantle boundary down at the bottom here. So here we're going forwards, and you'll see a breakthrough happening here, a massive flushing event passing across the mantle, collecting hot material at the other side of the core mantle boundary, and it would push up a plume at this side. So layering potentially can break down in time. We did 43 sorts of different cases varying the clapeyron slope at 660 and the Rayleigh number, the vigour of convection, and basically there would be dots across this figure, and this whole region here was regions where we got single layer convection. That phase change made no difference. In this region here, we had two-layered convection. And then there was a region in between where we would get partial layering, either in time, as I showed in the previous slide, or spatially, as is also possible, where certain regions are actually layered, but material is passing through in other regions. The Earth's values is sort of maybe somewhere up here. But over time, we would expect the vigor to decrease. So there's a potential in Earth history to have been maybe more layered in the past, as clearly Carolina hinted as well from different sort of mechanisms linked in with phase changes, and maybe today, at least in 660 terms, we might be somewhere over here, maybe. So that's all interesting. So the models I've just presented maybe show that a closed valve in principle is possible, maybe could show if it is possible that it would be significant and potentially time dependent, and could also evolve as the Earth evolved. But there's a big, big, big but. Those are just very simple models of mantle downwellings, and clearly the Earth, at least present day, we know has this very unique sort of subduction mode. So we're going to need models to cope with the complexity of subduction, and it's only probably by understanding those in some detail that we maybe can even hope to try and understand how the system might have worked in earlier times when we have even less evidence. So we're going to investigate some of this using a numerical model where we're going to solve the equations of mass, momentum, and energy. The initial cases are going to be in the Boussinesq approximation, so that's going to be incompressible with no dissipation, and there'll be some cases at the end where we're going to use what's called the extended Boussinesq approximation. That allows us to include viscous dissipation, the latent heat of the phase change, and adiabatic heating and cooling self-consistently. Okay, so the model is 2D, Cartesian, starts here at the surface but extends all the way to the base of the mantle and has a wide aspect ratio, so 10,000 kilometres wide. And we will have a viscosity jump, at least for most of the calculations, of a factor of 30 between the upper mantle and the lower mantle. The plates, so the initial condition is prescribed by two plates. They start with ridges at this side initially, though everything will be free to evolve in its own rights. These are going to be dynamic calculations. And then we prescribe the age of the overriding plate at the trench and of the subducting plate, and those initially are set up using a half-space cooling model, and we will vary the age of the SP, the subducting plate, and the initial age of the overriding plate to give different cases. And we started with just a little lip down into the mantle. The other thing we add, and we heard of a case of this earlier today with Nicolas, is a weak layer. So the rheology inside this whole volume is going to be using a self-consistent law. In practice, it's going to be a composite rheology at the top and diffusion creep at the base, with this one exception of this weak zone on the subducting plate going down to around 200 kilometers to the depth at which we initiate this subduction. So it has a slightly lower friction coefficient effectively, or dependence of the yield strength on pressure is weaker, and also it has a weaker maximum viscosity. And it's only 5 kilometers thick, and it can also generate its own internal strain weakening, as we'll see in a second. So this system will naturally allow it to cool, again from the surface, renewing an overriding plate, and as I say, the Boussinesq ones will be incompressible. The velocity boundary conditions is going to be free slip on the bottom and on the two sides, free surface at the top. So the free slip means on the sides means effectively it's a closed box, so there's no material coming in or out of the box, so it's a very isolated system. The thermal boundary layer is insulating on the two sides and is at this relatively cold temperature at the base, which means there's no thermal boundary layer at the base. There's no thermal boundary layer at the base, meaning there'll be no plume. So basically, this is only going to be driven by the action of the subducting system. So it's sort of isolating the system for us. The trench here will be free to move in response to the dynamics, and we'll see that will happen in some cases and not in others, but that will be totally driven by the internal equations. When we implement phase changes, we're going to implement it by the method of Christensen and Ewan, which gives them some width, so this isn't quite as sophisticated as clearly as what Carolina was telling us this morning. An extended Boussinesq approximation in that case, as I mentioned, these various things are in, including a reference adiabat, which is quite similar to Bosman and Van Kaken. Oh, that's weird. Okay, so that should say temperature there. Temperature and strain rate dependent viscosity. So these are the four viscosity laws that we have in. So we have a diffusion creep, which is temperature dependent. So temperature should be in red up there. Here we have dislocation creep. So we've got strain rate and temperature dependent rheologies here. The yield strength, which is based on the strain rate, and a piles type stress, which applies in the, well, largely plays a role in the slab. So here's just one snapshot out of one simulation, and you can see what I'm picturing here is the dominant deformation mechanism at any one moment in time. All these are actually playing a role in principle in the whole domain all the time. So clearly we're seeing dislocation creep around the edges of the subducting plate and beneath the plates, diffusion creep away, yielding close to where the bending and the weak zone is, etc. So all this is solved using fluidity. I guess we saw it mentioned just a bit earlier. It has automatic adaptive meshing, and we'll see that in action at the moment, and that's clearly very useful for a multi-scale system, which the subduction zone case, I believe, is when we compare with its global sort of potential impacts to its also to its very local variations in that weak zone. We can go to element sizes of between 400 meters and 200 kilometers. We have a free surface. We can handle sharp variations in viscosity. So just to give you a sense of that adaptive meshing, so these big elements at the base here of the mantle are about 200 kilometers across, but clearly up here we can't tell what size we're looking at. We can zoom in to the upper mantle, and now we can start to see some smaller scale elements, but clearly again regions which we can't discern. Clearly you can also see that we put a lot in right at the 660. As we go zoom even closer in, and I think I've died. Okay, so here we've got a snapshot of a specific model showing the temperature field. Here it's reached across the boundary of 660. Here's the strain rate on a log scale, and here's the viscosity on a log scale. And so we see that there are regions of strain rate weakening in the mantle and in the slab. And we also see that in the center of the core, this red region is regions that are reaching our maximum viscosity of 10 to the 25 or so pascal seconds. So basically a very strong sort of center region, even if the slab is being bent. And I'm now going to show you a case. It's in the Buzanescu approximation with no phase change, with an initial subducting plate age of 100 million years and the overriding plate age of 40 million years, to give you a sense as to how this behaves. Okay. So we're going to show, you're going to see four views. So here's temperature, and you can see the slab starting to speed up. It slows down once it reaches the upper mantle, lower mantle boundary with the higher viscosity. You can see how the rheology is kind of evolving, but along the sides is primarily dislocation creep, diffusion creep away from it, and then we've got it weakening somewhat in the slab itself, allowing it to deform, and you can see how the grid is automatically adapting to keep the resolution in the regions where we are wanting to lower down the errors. You can also see that while this region here had been flat in the transition zone, it's still continuing to sink through. So clearly nothing to stop the penetration. Maybe I should go back and emphasize one more thing. Let's run it again. And if you focus here, that's where the trench starts. I'll try and keep the arrow there, and you can see that this system is rolling back. So we've got active trench rollback in this case, and that's partly what gives us the inclined geometry that we see. Okay, so the streamlines, if you're getting rolled back, the material from this side has to find its way to this side. Remember, this is now a closed box in this case, and this is the route by which it does it. These streamlines just haven't been seeded. You can pretty much guess the flow in which is required there. If we zoom in, we can kind of see basically the slab itself is wanting to fall vertically, and it derives clearly the induced flow. Okay, so I showed you one example there. For an age of a downgoing plate and an age of an overriding plate, but clearly on the Earth's surface, we get the ages of plates subducting and overriding plates varies quite dramatically. So we're going to investigate the effect of only varying the initial subducting plate age or the overriding plate age and see what that does to the resulting slab morphology or trench dynamics. So firstly, we look at a case where we've kept the overriding plate age constant, 20 million years, but we've varied on the left-hand side. We've got an old subducting plate age of 100 million years, and on this side, it's a subducting plate age of only 20 million years. And as we go forward in time, this has descended to 3.2 million years, has descended to this depth. We can see it's descended clearly much more quickly than this case. It's also weakened the region around it, so it's kind of self-lubricating, which allows it to fall even faster. This with less lubrication is clearly being ultimately a little bit more delayed than you might predict. So there are feedbacks in this system. By this point, we can really tell quite obviously that there is slab rollback occurring. In this case, there is no slab rollback. And also now, because this is taking time to descend, we are losing thermal buoyancy, which means it'll descend more slowly again. We continue on down. This is now anchored. It's rolling back. It's actually even starting to bend and deform. This is falling more or less vertically. And as we go forward, here we've got flattening on this boundary. In this case, we've sort of more or less reached the boundary. We're starting to pile and fold up. This one we've called a vertically folded system, so no rollback. This case, an inclined with strong retreat. So now let's compare that with keeping the subducting plate age the same and changing the overriding plate age. And I'll just quickly go through this. So, go straight to the end of this case. And basically, even though they had the same subducting plate age, they look different once they enter into the lower mantle. This one is very much like the other one we saw, a vertically folded case. This one is very much like the other, horizontally inclined. And it was horizontally deflected in this case before it entered. So we give it a slightly different title, horizontally deflected case. And all those experiments can be plotted here. So this is the initial subducting plate age and the initial overriding plate age. And basically things happen in sort of two stages, a stage one until they reach the boundary and then stage two afterwards. If we combine the two stages, we discern four different sort of modes. If we focus just on the final stage, then maybe there's only two sort of examples, the vertically folded and then the ones that go to become inclined and retreating. So here is where they live. So if we have young initial subducting plate ages, we tend to get the vertically folded cases, and then the other ones tend to be for the stronger initial subducting plates, older subducting plate ages. So that was a factor of 13 viscosity. We'll take a look at times 10 times 100. And here's taking just one case. So this is one we've looked at. So this is the times 30. And this is one that gives us a horizontally sort of folded case and ultimately makes its way through. So these are the parameters of the initial ages, 40 and 20. If we have only a 10 factor of 10 jump, then actually, as you might shouldn't be surprised, this passes through a lot more easily and actually does roll back. In contrast, if we make it 100, while it descends quite quickly, it then finds great difficulty in penetrating and in fact sort of more or less breaks off and becomes a vertically folded case. So again, we can develop regime diagrams for these cases. So the vertically folded, when we have 10, only a 10 factor, means that many more can pass through, so this is a slightly smaller regime. If it's times 100, then it's a lot harder for them to fall down and roll back, etc., and keep their strength. So this whole region here with VF on it is potentially vertically folding. I'm now going to show you this case here, but for a different method. So in the Buzanesque approximation, we're getting it to be kind of an inclined, strong retreat and a little bit of this bent, then inclined and strong retreat. So it starts very strong in that sort of case. I haven't shown you those. Those are very strong initially, so they get this bent over thing, but all of them evolve such that they have this inclined thing. Okay, so we're there with the Buzanesque, and here we're going to be in the Buzanesque, but now we've put in a phase change, and basically you can probably guess that I don't quite run the movie long enough that clearly there's little or no hindrance at 660. The Clapeyron slope was about -2.4. So we ran, again, that whole region, and in fact, the regime diagram is identical. It doesn't change. On this case, we with an even higher Clapeyron slope, again, no change in the... here, we've with the extended Buzanesque, again, similar sorts of behavior. And if we jump to the regime diagram, then the vertically folded cases in this case are much more prominent. So it is having an effect on the sort of behavior that we do see. And if we add in a Clapeyron slope, again, for this case, it's very limited in terms of the change in behavior. But if we look at all the cases, I see this one's not going to show up very nicely. which maybe I'll go to this one instead. Basically, here I've put all the experiments down on sort of simple figures, looking at the final state. And basically, we see the Buzanesque approximation times 30 times 10 times 100. And we saw basically only a limited change in the vertically folding regime. Here at the long stage, we saw there was quite a bit of a difference. The Buzanesque with a phase change, no difference. The extended Buzanesque was leading to more of the vertically folding, so that it was weaker. And in this case, with the phase change, there was a little bit weaker again. And it looks a little bit different when we're at the initial sort of stages in sort of the phase one of this process. In particular, we get some break off here, and the vertically folded is not always quite as obvious. Comparing to data, there's lots of experiments being done for us on Earth, lots of different subduction zones, lots of issues with it. Comparison here out of the work of Lallemand, deep slab dip versus age, little or no correlation between present-day age at the trench and the slab geometry. Okay, so here's a case where we started with this orientation. Initial plate age, subducting plate age 100, 20 in the overriding plate, and after 16 million years, this was what we got, the inclined strong retreat. If we use this case, 40 million years initially for subducting, 100 for the overriding plate age, after 65 million years, this is the case that we got, a vertically folded case. But note, the age at the trench, which you can tell here, is identical. So these are two cases with exactly the same age at the trench of 100 million years, but they've ended up evolving to very different cases. Okay, so to conclude, clearly there are quite a few limitations even with this intentionally simplified system. Clearly things missing, like we've got a fixed grain size, no crust, etc., very limited phase change, but maybe the more obvious thing is that we're in 2D. So to conclude, we've got a lot of system feedbacks here. We've got a coupling between the strength and the buoyancy, coupling between the dynamics and the strength. So deformation can change the rheology, can change the flow, can change the deformation. There can be subtle balances. Small changes sometimes we see make a difference, and in other cases they weren't making such a difference. Okay, so it's actually quite a subtle, finely balanced system, it seems. Trench motion and rheology are clearly keys to understanding that slab deformation, in both the trench rollback being significant, and then the regime diagrams telling us we can get a wide range of slab morphologies, which at least for the deep subducting morphologies, we recover, you know, the end members, the very steep ones and the dipping ones. The importance of evolution is clearly important if we want to compare to present-day slab plate ages at the trench. And basically, this valve is complicated. Subducting slab buoyancy and strength is clearly the most important. Maybe the most important thing from where I started this whole thing, the motivation, the valve in all these cases is open. Okay? All these cases, we had material pass through that boundary. So all modelled slabs descend through 660, even if they lie out flat on the boundary for a time, and even if they vary the descent rate. But ultimately, all those were passing through. Thanks so much.